So, today we're going to be exploring Oklahoma as a microcosm of the energy world and discussing what that tells us about the future of energy in the U.S. As many of you know, Oklahoma is a top oil and gas producing state. According to the EIA, it was ranked fifth in onshore oil production in 2013. The state's independent oil and gas producers helped pioneer the horizontal drilling and fracturing methods that have fueled the energy boom. But as I'm sure many of you know, we are now in a bust, and oil has been trading around $50 a barrel, much lower than the highs that we saw last year, which were over 100. And the question is, natural gas is also very low. It goes for less than those caramel macchiatos I like to get at Starbucks. Great for electricity prices and gasoline prices, but what does it mean for renewable energy technologies like wind turbines and solar panels? You know, how do we integrate those newer types of resources into our aging electric grid? How do they compete with traditional electricity resources? And speaking of electricity, how many new natural gas pipelines do we actually need to feed our power plants, and how will the EPA's Clean Energy Power Plan and various new emissions rules for power plants and refineries change things? Where do environmental concerns fit into all of this, particularly as grassroots groups and communities push back against oil and gas drilling, pipeline construction, and even projects like Cape Wind? So here today to help us discuss all of these matters are panelists. I'll introduce them alphabetically. So we'll start with Denise Bodie, who is attorney and principal at Cornerstone Government Affairs, where she is part of the energy practice group. Many of you might recognize Ms. Bodie, as she is the former head of the American Wind Energy Association. She also led the American Clean Skies Foundation, and she sat on the Oklahoma Corporation Commission for 10 years. And she has been president of the Independent Petroleum Association of America. She also wanted me to mention that she is a native Oklahoman. Next, we have Kyle Eisenhower, who is vice president of regulatory and economic policy at the American Petroleum Institute. He's a 20-year veteran of API, and in his time there, has helped oversee the Institute's development of climate policies, advocated for the oil and gas industry, waste management, aviation, and air quality issues. And finally, we have Jim Roth, director of clean energy practice at the law firm Phillips Murrah. He also served on the Oklahoma Corporation Commission, was twice elected a commissioner in Oklahoma County, and he is part of the advisory board for the Institute for Energy Law and is on the board of the American Clean Skies Foundation. He is not a native of Oklahoma, but he's here by choice. Now, a few audience instructions. We'll leave 30 minutes at the end of our discussion for questions. Per SEJ rules, working journalists and SEJ members have priority. And if you feel like there's something that you want to address or to have addressed while we are up here speaking, feel free to tweet me a question at Aylworth. That's my last name, A-I-L-W-O-R-T-H. And if I see it and can fit it in, I will do so. All right? Ready, guys? All right. So we will start with the energy landscape in Oklahoma. Natural gas and coal are used to generate nearly 80% of the state's electricity, according to the EIA. But renewables, notably wind and hydropower, account for the rest. So Denise, if you could give us an overview of what's been going on and how Oklahoma stacks up.
The modern natural gas industry really began in Oklahoma when they built one of the first high-pressure interstate oil natural gas pipelines from the Hugoton Basin to Chicago, allowing for natural gas to be marketed not just locally but over long distances. It changed the whole dynamic in the industry. Also in 1907, when they passed our Constitution, Oklahoma has a very unique constitution, and the Oklahoma Corporation Commission that Jim and I had the honor of serving on was a constitutional agency. And we were the largest socialist population, or population of people who identified themselves as socialists in the country. So it was a very populist constitution. The regulation of oil and gas and utilities and transportation, rail, barges, etc., was all granted to the Oklahoma Corporation Commission. And so there was a great opportunity to provide oversight of that industry for the good of the people. And that's always been a very important part and element of that. But that also led, for the energy industry perspective, it led to the commission establishing a lot of ground rules on conservation policies, on regulation and oversight, that really led the way as the oil and gas industry began to have oversight in other parts of the oil-producing parts of the country. So some of the first Interstate Oil and Gas Compact Commission was created here in Oklahoma. I think it's a real interesting foundation. You have to know that about Oklahoma. And, of course, right now when you look at Oklahoma, we're about as red can be. But to have that understanding of the development and the role that we played in terms of the oversight of the industry, I think is critical to understand. Also, our love and our interest in growing all forms of energy. And Oklahoma is very much an energy producer in every way. It truly has an all-of-the-above portfolio. We're number 5 in oil and gas production, in fuel for electricity. Also, Oklahoma also ranks 5th in the U.S. in natural gas production. 43% of its electricity comes from gas. 4th in the U.S. in electricity produced from wind, with 15% of its electricity from wind. We have some coal production in the eastern part of the state, less than 1%, but 35% of our electricity is produced from coal shipped by rail from the Powder River Basin. We also have almost 6% of electricity, and that range is based on, you know, whether we have a drought or how the rivers are going, but we do have 6% of our electricity from hydro from our over 200 lakes. Finally, there was a decision a number of years ago, a positive decision that was made by the commission and the public in general, not to add nuclear to our portfolio. So we are one of these, we're one of the few states in the country that does not have nuclear as part of our overall portfolio.
So next I want to turn to the oil and gas industry in Oklahoma. Obviously, it's a huge part of the economy here. And an important supplier for the rest of the nation's energy needs. And so I'm hoping you can talk a little bit about that, Kyle.
Sure. Thanks, Erin, and thanks for having me here today. It's really a pleasure to be here. as Erin said, the oil and gas industry is critically important to Oklahoma's economy. There are 364,000 jobs here in the state of Oklahoma that are supported by the oil and gas industry. So that's direct, indirect, and induced jobs. That's as of 2011 reports from PricewaterhouseCoopers using BLS data. The oil and gas industry further supports about $39 billion in economic activity. That's more than 23% of Oklahoma's GDP. So clearly, the oil and gas industry is critically, critically important to the economy of Oklahoma. I'd also note that a separate survey that was conducted by my organization, American Petroleum Institute, identified that there are at least 2,500 vendors here in the state that provide goods and services to the oil and gas industry. So again, it's not just those direct jobs. There's an awful lot of indirect jobs by companies that are providing goods and services to the industry as well. And the last thing I would note on this point is in terms of salaries, oil and gas jobs are extremely well paying. The average upstream oil and gas job pays around $95,000 a year. The average salary for in the state of Oklahoma for the average worker in Oklahoma is about half of that. So clearly the oil and gas industry is providing a real economic stimulus and a real economic benefit to the state of Oklahoma.
So given that importance, how do you balance the industry versus what we want to do environmentally, the goals to use wind power, to use solar power, to try and be a little bit better to the environment?
Well, I'd say that there is a balancing act. The administration often talks about how they have an all-of-the-above strategy. Well, frankly, an all-of-the-above strategy is something that the oil and gas industry was talking about long before the administration did. And in fact, we recognize that there is a place for all forms of energy in our nation's energy mix. And in fact, if you look at investments in lower and zero carbon technologies, a lot of that investment's actually coming from the oil and gas industry. Since 2000, if you look at the entities out there, whether it's industry or government that has invested in zero and low carbon technologies, federal government is number one. They've invested about $110 billion since 2000 in zero or low carbon technologies. The oil and gas industry is actually the top industry sector. We've invested about $90 billion in zero and low carbon technologies since 2000. The next closest industry sector is actually the automobile sector at only $38 billion. So clearly the oil and gas industry is doing more than just producing oil and gas. In fact, many of my members, they consider themselves energy companies much more so than oil and gas companies. We do recognize that we need it all, and there's a place within our growing energy demand for all forms of energy.
Jim and Denise, jump in on this.
Sure, I'll speak to that for a moment. First of all, good afternoon and welcome to Norman, Oklahoma. We're thrilled that you're here. Hopefully you can hear me better if I lean towards the microphone. Anyway, welcome to Oklahoma, welcome to Norman. First want to say that this is not a town that's typically this empty, but everybody's at the Cotton Bowl fighting the University of Texas in football. So enjoy these streets and no traffic. Just to add a couple complimentary thoughts perhaps to what Denise and Kyle both have mentioned, and then Aaron's question about how do you balance energy and the need for America's consumption of energy with the environment that we have the need to protect. I wanted to expand a little bit on what Denise mentioned. You know, we are a blessed state in terms of what resources we have below the ground, and now we're learning of our resources above the ground. Oklahoma does not produce any coal production for its own use in terms of power generation, which is typical. We have a metallurgical value for it in terms of steel, but its sulfur content is so high that it's not used. And so I share that as an example because our policymakers do that type of cost-benefit analysis to figure out what is the right purpose and how do you apply tax incentives to a particular industry because its purpose should be really for what it's best natively designed to do. We don't have nuclear, as was mentioned, but we have incredible wind opportunities above the ground. As Denise mentioned, right now we have an estimate of over 25,000 megawatts of high-quality wind predicted in the western part of our state in the Oklahoma Panhandle. That's why we're called the Saudi Arabia of wind. Well, that means we'll be in the exporting business for wind also beyond, just as we do in natural gas. To Aaron's question, why is that important? Well, we need public policy and visionaries that realize that we are going to be incentivizing the attraction of capital to develop that for the sake of the nation. And that we can't just be insulated in our thinking in terms of our tax treatment. The ad valorem impact is enormous for those areas. And you start to see some of that tension. As Kyle was mentioned, this is an oil and gas state, but we were at the state's peak of production in 1928 without conservation statutes about how we went about doing it. Oklahoma's regulatory regime didn't really get its muscle until the 30s. And now our oil and gas operators have a genuine responsibility to really responsibly deplete a reserve or reservoir in a geological formation rather than the first 30 years of existence in this state where they would pump their small holes into the ground, often leave those as abandoned wells, and those orphans became the responsibility of subsequent people if those companies were still in business. So I share all that to say we are learning our way through every form of energy as a state, a relatively young state. But I would answer Aaron's question mostly as it takes public policy matching trends in energy production to make sure that the environment is handled appropriately and that our country and our state in particular are still benefited by access to that energy that we seem to have a great abundance beyond our own needs for.
I would add just to that, and I think you all have heard some really good responses here. Oklahoma, you know, has really, again, I want to go back to the point I made about setting some good examples in terms of the industry and the regulator working together. One of the things that the industry did in Oklahoma that was really another first was when the Oklahoma Independent Oil and Gas Producers decided to start what they call as a checkoff program, where they basically taxed themselves to clean up orphan and abandoned wells in the state. So basically, they took a portion of, you know, the money they would otherwise be profit to them and rolled it back into a statewide fund to go around and clean up abandoned well sites that people had gone bankrupt or just left around the country. And they have cleaned up, you know, tens of thousands of sites that otherwise would be eyesores and turned it back and rehabilitated it back into useful land and useful opportunities. And that happened because the state worked together with the industry to do that. And I think that's a leading program in the country for doing the right thing and doing it well. The other thing I would add is on the renewable side, and so that's really, I think, a very positive example of how the industry can work together to set the right example. And I would urge other you to look at that program more, because I think other states could be doing the very same thing. And it's going to be critically important in this oil boom to really make sure that as we look across the country and we have new states that really haven't been major oil and gas producers, that they put in place policies that really take care of these wells and not allow them to get to the point where they're abandoned and no longer useful so that future generations have to come and clean it up. But I would say one other thing on the renewable side in general. Oklahoma actually started in the renewable clean energy sector in the 30s when the Government Works Program helped us build some of our first hydroelectric dams in the 1930s. We got involved in the wind by the commission, working with the private sector and our utilities, by working through rate cases to add incentives for the utilities to add wind generation to their portfolios and incentivize individuals and companies to sign up for wind. And so it actually began as a process that really got the public involved and excited about adding wind to our portfolio. And it really did it really saved our consumers a huge amount of money in the process and really kind of became a market-driven as well as an oversight and industry and private sector as well as a regulatory prospect for this development.
All right. We've got an audience question. What do the panelists think of local control of oil and gas development? And I'm assuming that that's state versus federal?
Sure. I can speak to that issue here in Oklahoma. That's a debate that our state has just gone through. The legislative answer to that was to centralize primacy at the state level and not to allow local control of oil and gas issues. As Denise mentioned, from the Constitution and the start of statehood, certainly into the conservation statutes in the 30s, that has been a state responsibility. Local concern obviously associated with the local impact and the issues of induced seismicity that you heard mentioned at the top of the hour have obviously raised concern from constituents in particular jurisdictions. And if any of you who have been in local public office, you realize when you go to the grocery store, you learn about every pothole that citizen experience on their way to the store, and there's a sense of greater access and accountability with their local officials. And so that's who they've been talking to. And sometimes the statewide regulator may be a state as large as Texas, where they're in Austin and someone out in Laredo may not know who they are, wants to talk to that local person. It's certainly understandable. With the frequency of earthquakes, that's become obviously a very hot button issue. As was mentioned, we have more earthquakes in the small state of Oklahoma than the state of California. More Oklahomans now insure their home with earthquake insurance than in California on a proportional basis. So it's something on the minds of our neighbors here. One of the fears, though, on behalf of the state, for the reasons that Denise mentioned about the enormous impact of energy across the GDP, is that if you end up with a knee-jerk reaction locally, what does that mean in terms of an impact to the state's economy? I'm not suggesting that the legislature opted for an economic answer rather than an ecological answer, but I think they did conclude on what they thought was the most public policy efficiency question. I'd followed this issue in New York, for many of you that probably have, in the Finger Lakes region. We followed this issue in Denton, Texas, and what's going on in the Barnett Shale and that urban play, and Ohio's going through something similar, and every state is going to go through these issues. Mostly, though, because of our own regulatory regime being, I think, sufficient enough, and our state's energy production having matured over decades, the answer was right in Oklahoma to to do it at the state level. But I think you're going to see that play out differently depending on the state and their legal precedent.
And I would just add to that, I think that's a really good question. Because I think that what you say, and Jim, having been, you know, an Oklahoma County Commissioner, really understands the importance of having that local voice. But I think Oklahoma's regulatory structure, having been constitutional, requiring elected officials to manage the process, have to have their ear to the ground and have to listen to local interest and to the individual interest, probably more so than in many states where they're appointed otherwise. And I think, you know, the process before the commission provides for an open forum before any of these provisions are passed that would allow a local official or individuals that have concerns to present their concerns before the commission, and the commission can respond to them. So I agree with Jim. I agree with Jim's assessment on that point.
Yeah, and I'd say I also agree that Oklahoma got it right. At the state levels, where you're going to have experts who are well versed enough in the technical issues that really need to be addressed here, so that they can make an informed decision about energy development versus environment versus and keeping the economy in account as well. At the local level, Jim mentioned knee-jerk reaction, and that can obviously happen. You also don't necessarily have the technical expertise at
that's
the local
important.
Level,
that's
and
important.
That really is important to make an informed decision on these issues. And that's why, again, state level really is the appropriate place for it.
So then where do federal regulations fit in? There's been a lot of talk of the EPA's Clean Power Plan and quite a bit of talk around new methane emission rules. I have an audience question here asking you, Kyle, if API is set on clean energy, why are they fighting ozone standards to clean up smog from coal plants?
Okay. Well, a couple different questions there. First of all, as it pertains to ozone, regulations, the previous standard was set at 75 parts per billion, and under that standard, we were seeing significant reduction in ozone levels across the nation, and we're seeing more and more areas coming into attainment. So by moving it down to 70 parts per billion, you're not necessarily going to see additional reductions. The same reductions that you were already getting when at 75, you're still going to get at 70. So you're not necessarily speeding up emissions reductions. But what you are doing is you're setting up the nation for failure, quite honestly. At 70 parts per billion, you are so close to background levels, and there's background levels of ozone up at around 60 parts per billion or greater, in what they call design value numbers. So as a result, you're essentially establishing a non-attainable standard, and you're putting about a third of the country into non-attainment. And when you've got a third of the country in non-attainment, it essentially is a tremendous, tremendous economic drag on the ability, and it really limits your ability to expand manufacturing or, in my case, expand oil and gas development. So it's a very important issue, not only for my industry, but for many industries across the country.
And I'll speak to that for a moment. I may be the only Oklahoman you meet today that thinks the EPA is not a four-letter word. I also think the Clean Power Plan has a lot of promise for American ingenuity in a state like Oklahoma with clean energy answers. And so I guess I would say in general, when you know better, you do better. And we in America are realizing the impacts of industrial process and power generation in particular on the impacts to our families and to our economy. And the same, and I share Kyle's concern that we don't want something that is so disruptive that you have a negative impact on the economy, but that we could maybe incrementally tweak our way through some better answers and land at a better place. As many of you probably know, the United States government has a few academies, one of those does some great research, Academy of Science, with Congressional Research Service. And recently they concluded that the external cost of power generation is something we're already paying for. So when we talk about cheap energy and we talk about perhaps trying to ignore the carbon impact. We're really talking about separating external costs that your family is bearing at the hospital and through healthcare from the cost of electricity. And so I think we in this country that have led the world in terms of our industrial process and our access to energy and what we do with it could also lead the world in solving the solution and honestly beginning with kind of this $0 equation. What I mean by that is, if you believe the Congressional Research Service, about 3.2 cents per kilowatt hour of coal power is something you're already paying in healthcare, and nearly 1.4 cents per kilowatt hour in natural gas. And so we're already having those effects across our economy. And so I worry a little about when I hear someone say that it's a jobs killer, which seems to be the phrase in DC. It could be a job creator if we're smart and are, again, appropriate with our timeline. I'm not saying something by 2020 is possible. Utilities plan for 40 years, and we've got to realize that that's a safe place. You know, Parker Brothers probably got it right when the utility space was a safe place to land. Your way around the monopoly board. But it can't just sit there. And so I wanted to offer kind of a complimentary thought. I hope it is complimentary, that I don't worry about the Clean Power Plan. I know it's going to get litigated, ultimately whatever it comes down with. I have faith that we Americans can find our way through what's necessary in the future. And I also think that if we don't, the paradigm shift that's underway for those monopolistic integrated utilities are just going to shorten their demise sooner than they otherwise might with distributed generation and in-home energy solutions that many Americans are going to want from their thermostat like they now have in their phone. So a lot of thoughts to that issue. It's a complicated issue, but I do think the EPA has a role to play, and states like ours just push back politically without realizing that Oklahoma's natural gas, wind, and even solar penetration are part of the answer. We're too caught up in the political answer at the moment. I think we just need a broader conversation as Americans to get to that cleaner place.
All right. I want to talk about price and a little bit about policy, and we'll bring up methane emissions there. But, you know, everybody talks about the competitiveness of renewables and how they can be more competitive with oil, with gas, with coal, especially right now when we're dealing with such low crude prices, with such low natural gas prices. How do we keep these newer technologies, these other resources that we're starting to use, how do we keep them competitive? How do we work them into our system? And what policies do we need to make that happen?
Well, I think that's a really good question. And when I was at AWEA, we really did a deep dive into that question in reviewing our competitive with, you know, the principal competitor that wind really is natural gas. Natural gas is the main competitor for everybody now. Is from a historical standpoint, it is now the top producer of electric generation in the country for the first time, really, you know, forever. But we did a deep dive in that, and we also looked at it from the standpoint of the possibility of tax reform and the change in the incentives that might be available for renewable energy. The key factors really are how fast manufacturing improvements in technology could increase wind capacity factors, as well as reductions in capital costs. You know, technology has continued to improve really with taller towers, larger rotors, increased turbine reliability and availability, and better siting technology, really to increase capacity factors. For example, the wind turbines installed today are really almost double the capacity that they were in 1990. You know, from what used to be a 1 megawatt turbine, now, you know, the more standard size turbine is 2 megawatts. And it's in the same footprint, so you're not having to, you know, to basically put it in a new place. They're at greater heights, you know, 100 meters is not uncommon anymore, and of course, that means more capacity. The wind industry is now providing, 20 plus years purchase power agreements to utilities, 2 to 3 cents a kilowatt hour, which is very competitive with natural gas. Of course, that does include the production tax credit, you know, which adds additional value to the producer. So, of course, the other path to parity would be higher natural gas prices. So, you know, those things are all the key factors that we really looked at when you talk about the competitiveness. Obviously, too, the key thing that you think about with with wind is it isn't always where it needs to be. Just as in the natural gas industry, we had to build that first high-pressure gas pipeline from the Hugoton to Chicago, we need to build transmission to move the power where it needs to go. And so there are many hurdles, obviously, in building new transmission, new pipeline. All energy infrastructure will have those hurdles, but that's a key factor. Those are some of the things to think about, at least.
And I guess I, in a small way, I challenge the premise of the question a little bit, because it seems to be premised on the idea that natural gas, because it is so competitive at low cost, it is not allowing us to make environmental gains. And that's not really true. If you look at the reductions in CO2 that we've seen from the power generation sector since 2005, it's about 1.6 billion tons of carbon that has not been emitted because of a number of factors. Well, the largest one of those factors is natural gas. About 1 billion of that 1.6 billion in carbon reductions has actually come from fuel switching from coal to natural gas. Only 0.6 has come from the advent of renewables. So it's not that natural gas is not providing environmental benefit. I'd say it actually is providing significant environmental benefit.
I think that's a huge point. I just wanted to add to that. I think it's one of the unsung stories about the shale renaissance, really, is what's happened in the former pollution space compared to where it is today. I wish more Americans understood that, because it is a bit of the trade-off that I think is a fair part of the conversation. I'll just give you some real numbers of what's happened in Oklahoma's power gen market, at least today. Our state's largest utility gets gas delivered to it for about $30 a megawatt hour. That's before it's burnt, that's before an employee shows up to work, that's before tax treatment for M&O across their rate base. They get coal delivered, as Denise mentioned, from the Powder River Basin because of its low sulfur content, for about $26 per megawatt hour. Again, before a rock is burnt. Wind energy, because of the higher hub height, because of the improved capacity factors, because of the ability of this technology to lock in prices on a 20-year PPA, is being bid into this state and exported to neighboring states for around $18. Energy, $18. Granted, that has a $23 tax treatment associated with it. But when I hear people say, we need to level the playing field, well, then coal and gas should strip out every tax incentive associated with its production if you want to compare a megawatt hour of energy to each other and be fair. But that never seems to be the second part of that comment. So right now in Oklahoma, green is economic. In many states, it's ecological. But here, it's winning the day. And the cleanest form of energy happens to be the cheapest. And then you can debate tax issues, but on a dollar for dollar, the ratepayer only sees, or the customer only sees, their utility bill. So I'm a huge fan of renewable energy in the sense that it's a hedge against, physical and financial hedge against volatility in coal or gas. And we can debate the tax treatment all you want, but at the end of the day, I would rather have a non-fuel-based, non-emitting resource that feels safer to me. So I just wanted to add that comment, that I think that's an important point. Tax treatment happens across every form of energy, and it seems to be lost when you talk about wind only.
Well, so maybe we can delve into that. What role, what role are subsidies and tax breaks playing in the energy space, both for the traditional fuels and for the renewable fuels, and did I already ask them? what role can they play, are they playing, and should they play? And maybe you can kick us off.
Okay, well, since we're talking about subsidies and tax treatment, obviously I can only speak to oil and gas. What I can tell you is that there's a myth, if you will, that the oil industry gets unfair tax breaks or subsidies. That is not true. A subsidy, obviously, is when the government's paying you to produce energy. Government does not pay the oil and gas industry to produce energy. We do have some provisions in the tax code for cost recovery. As with any capital-intensive industry, you need to continually invest and reinvest your earnings in the next well so that you can continue to produce energy. And like other resource industries, we have provisions in the tax code that allow us to recover those costs on an accelerated schedule. So rather than amortizing over 20 years, you're recovering it in the first year. And that allows us to put that money into the next well. But really, it's really not very different if you want to think of it as it's our R&D, because I mean that is our R&D is drilling wells and finding new sources of energy, and obviously R&D is an acceptable tax provision tax deduction for all industries, and one other thing I'll just mention, because I'm guessing there's probably a whole bunch of people in this audience that are hearing what I'm saying right now with a certain amount of skepticism. So let's just take a look at effective tax rates. The oil and gas industry paid in the second quarter of 2015 paid an effective tax rate of 43%. That is the highest industry sector effective tax rate for companies headquartered here in the United States. The average effective tax rate for other industries is about 30%. So if we're getting unfair tax breaks, I sure would like to see why it is that we're paying so much.
Do you think these tax breaks and subsidies should continue? And I think before that, I also want to address the incentives that that renewables get.
Well, I think I mentioned in talking about the considerations for wind and its competitiveness, that, the role that the production tax credit plays, which is a critical role for, making wind more competitive in terms of getting, purchase power agreements. It helps keep the cost down for doing that. When I was at OEO, one of the things we looked at, because we were obviously very conscious of the fact that both the public and the Congress and the president have all talked about putting in place major tax reform, both individual and corporate tax reform. And so we were asked the question, if all sectors, if the oil and gas, if wind, if renewables, if everyone is going to look at putting together a new tax scheme, both public and private, what would it take? And so the reason I shared with you those factors is those were the considerations. How many manufacturing cycles would we go through, and how many years, before the price could basically replace the production tax credit? And those were the factors that went into the calculation on how much longer we would need to have the tax credit. I just say, as former president of the Independent Petroleum Association of America, the oil and gas industry had a tax credit. What Kyle is talking about, and I'm a tax attorney by training, worked on Senate Finance Committee for David Boren. I'm very familiar with the energy tax credits across the board. And I would say that what Kyle is saying is correct. The oil and gas industry has cost recovery provisions as opposed to a tax credit, which the production tax credit is. But the oil and gas industry also had a tax credit called the Non-Conventional Fuels Tax Credit, or the Section 29 tax credit, that it had for 20 plus years. And that tax credit was and helped develop the new kinds of wells we're seeing now being drilled, high water cut wells, non-conventional fuel gas production, and oil production from those wells. And so the industry utilized that very type of incentive, almost the equivalent in terms of value to the production tax credit, to really help develop and to prove the case that we could drill these new wells from shale. Maybe they weren't focused on shale, but they were focused on the kind of production methods that fracking and high water production, what you do with it. So I would just say that the tax incentives and the tax credits are critically important, have been critically important since the 1920s, when we passed the first, percentage depletion, intangible drilling costs, offsets for geological and geophysical expenses. And so this is critical. It's been important for every sector of the energy industry to help prove up the case. The oil and gas industry basically agreed to give up the Section 29 non-conventional fuels tax credit when it really became proven. So that was really kind of the discussion we were having in the wind industry. At what point would it be proven so that it would be a logical extension to move on? So just to give you a little background and insight in some of the discussions we had on the renewable side.
All right, and I am being told we are almost ready for for the audience members to start asking questions. So you guys can go ahead and line up. We had hoped to touch on a whole lot more topics, so I'm hoping some of you will bring them up. Earthquakes, anyone? But before we jump to the audience, I want each of our panelists to take out their crystal balls and. And give us their thoughts on what the major energy issues are coming up and what needs to be addressed. And I will have Denise start us off because ladies first.
Thank you very much. Well, I'll be very brief because I think I probably talk too much, as I tend to do because this is my favorite subject. I think there are three or four critical things we need to do. I think our energy infrastructure needs modernizations. It needs to be made more efficient, and we need to work to continually upgrade the safe transportation utilizing our energy infrastructure. I think it needs to be hardened because of climate issues, we increasingly are having transmission issues in Oklahoma, for example. We were with ice storms and the increasing severe climate, the cost of replacing because we're not hardening them when we replace them is really can be extraordinary for consumers. So our energy infrastructure needs to be hardened, needs to be modernized, it needs to go where it needs to go as opposed to just, you know, replacing existing. And also we need to address cybersecurity. I think one of the key things all of us should be concerned about with the hacking and the incidents we've seen both in the private sector and government in recent days really points to the fact that we need to do a really good job, a much better job, for the sake of our own national security and because for the sake of the public, to basically have a much stronger prevention on the cybersecurity side. And I think the final thing that I would say is I really truly believe, well, two other things. One other thing is I really think we need to deal with the issue of water. And we haven't asked that question here, so I hope somebody does, but I do think we need to work on incentivizing water conservation and recycling of water in this country, both by use for energy, but just in general by the public, because I think it's a valuable resource that we haven't put as much of a price on, and we need to do a better job of taking care of our water supplies.
You know, a fellow Oklahoman, T. Boone Pickens, says whiskey's for drinking and water's for fighting. I think you're probably right. It's overlooked too often. I guess to answer your question about a crystal ball, my prediction would be what I would describe as the power of the individual. I think we're at a transformative time in America and perhaps the world where that child born in 2015 that graduates high school in 2033 is going to be looking at the world completely different in their energy footprint, their access to energy. Just as I learned not to call family and friends in the 90s till after 7 p.m. and began to get price signals in telecommunication, and now you have this type of capability as small as this device in our hand, consumer-driven today, I think our energy palette is going to be the next generation. I think the ability to generate power in your own home or business, the ability to use less than your footprint otherwise was, driven by finally transparency in those issues. If the Edison Electric Institute's predictions are right about the amount of electricity that comes back to the grid at night from your electric vehicle by 2040, it's a different world, and I think it's going to be more about the individual than we've ever seen before.
Amen.
Okay.
I'd echo a couple of things that Denise said. First of all, I think infrastructure is an absolutely critical issue going forward for the energy industry, all forms of energy, not just oil and gas. But I can tell you that within the next 10 years or so, there will probably be another trillion dollars in investment in infrastructure just associated with oil and gas, whether it's pipelines, rail, marine, et cetera. So I think that's going to be a huge, huge issue and a huge economic driver. I also think cyber is going to be a very, very important issue as we go forward. And as more of our systems are automated, cyber becomes just that much more critically important to us to ensure that we don't have disruptions to our grid and to our energy delivery systems. And the last thing I would say, just in terms of a prediction, I think the other big energy issue going forward over the next 10 years is probably going to be energy exports. I would imagine that within 10 years we're probably exporting about 2 million barrels a day of crude oil. I'd be surprised if we're not also exporting somewhere on the order of about 10 billion cubic feet per day of liquefied natural gas.
All right, so we are going to open it to the audience now. Just as a reminder, working journalists and SEJ members take priority, and before you start asking your question, which I hope is succinct, and if you have commentary, I hope that is short as well, you must introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Peter Fairley. I'm a freelance journalist based in Victoria, British Columbia. I want to drill down a little on the question of natural gas as a meaningful transition fuel. We know now from satellite and air flight measurements of direct emissions that there's far more methane coming out of the oil and gas production sector than is accounted for by industry and EPA estimates. It's enough of a difference to wipe out the climate advantage of burning natural gas versus coal as a fuel. And actually, when we were out on our tour on Thursday, the energy sector tour, we were present for two gas vents that released methane directly into the air. My sense is that the U.S. producers are resisting limits on flaring, and I guess I'm wondering, are we really asking as much from the oil and gas sector as we could in the run-up to the Paris talks?
Well, I would challenge to a certain extent the argument that the methane that is vented is sufficient enough to offset the CO2 gains. I believe that there's probably a little cherry picking in terms of some of that analysis. More realistically, I do look at the EPA numbers because that's the government data that we have to work with, and government data actually shows that methane emissions from the oil and gas industry has been dropping. This is just released earlier this week. Has been dropping now for the third year in a row. So when we talk about new methane rulemaking from EPA, which actually just came out not too long ago, about a month ago. You wonder what's really driving them, because if you look at the costs and the benefits associated with that proposed rule, their costs and benefits are almost identical. It's essentially a one-for-one. Personally, I've been working, EPA rules for about 20 years now, and I've never seen an EPA proposal where the costs and benefits were essentially the same. Usually it's 10 to 1, 100 to 1, et cetera. Here's one where they even acknowledge, even in their own rulemaking, in their cost-benefit analysis, that they're really not capturing that much methane. This appears to me, at least, when we're talking about methane rule from EPA, that this is a lot of posturing, that the industry has made advancements on their own, and what EPA is really trying to accomplish here is to present a good face going into Paris. But again, if you look at the data, 38% reduction in methane emissions since 2005 from gas production, and then from fracking itself, from the actual activity surrounding hydraulic fracturing, methane reductions have been on the order of nearly 80%.
But that's all based on registries, estimates. It's not based on emissions.
And obviously we need better evaluation and measurements, but to the extent we can work with only what we've got, and I have no problem with using flyovers and using infrared cameras to try to get better measurements. I think that's a good thing. We need to get the best, most accurate measurements we can, but the measurements that we've got so far are showing that the industry is actually doing a pretty good job of reducing methane emissions.
What about hurdles like infrastructure? I know that North Dakota has you know, been trying to implement flaring rules, but have been running into problems because the infrastructure to actually put that gas into a pipeline rather than flaring it and creating emissions is just not there.
Mm-hmm. And that's a real challenge. And as I said, infrastructure is a big issue, and we need to upgrade the infrastructure so that we can capture that. Keep in mind, the industry doesn't want to vent methane. It doesn't want to flare methane. Methane is the primary component of natural gas. We would much rather collect it and sell it, right? That's profit for us. So if we can get the infrastructure in place, and again, that's, you know, permitting and siting is difficult, but if we can get it in place, that's our preferred approach.
I would just simply add to Peter's question. I'm not a scientist, so I don't have the ability to offer that opinion, but the aggregated science, as I understand it, whether perceived or real, is either going to be answered by the industry and it becomes a longer bridge fuel, as a lot of people have predicted, or it's not, and it becomes, in my opinion, a stepping stone to an undebated cleaner form of landing. So I think that's part of the dilemma right now is I don't know one producer, and I know many of them across this state, that does that intentionally or voluntarily. So if the extraction process in some remote locations are still at a point where that's required, then they need to be a part of the dialogue to figure out how they diminish that so where the huge benefits of transitioning to that source are not lost on that reluctance.
All right. Sarah Terry Cobo with the Journal Record newspaper in Oklahoma City. I'm interested in if you panelists think it's possible to have a moderate conversation about long-term energy policy, and I see this particularly in Oklahoma, that, you know, environmentalists want to talk about transition to 100% renewables, and drillers accuse them of wanting to send us back to the dark ages. And similarly, environmentalists accuse drillers of sending us to the dark ages by creating greenhouse gas pollution that contributes to climate change, not to mention spills, particulate matter, methane, and air toxics pollution. So can we bring these opposite ends of the spectrum together to actually create a long-term energy policy, whatever that really looks like?
As the only former, you know, that is actually part of my crystal ball, is that, you know, and what I hope that can happen, having bridged that gap in my career, having worked for both the oil and gas industry and for the renewable sector and for an idea, which was the Clean Skies Foundation, that would provide that kind of a bridge and dialogue between the environmental community, the renewable community, and the oil and gas industry, I truly believe that question has to be answered. We tried to do that through the foundation we set up at AWEA by trying to pull together a dialogue between all different sectors. And I think you're right, it has become so politicized, but for the good of the country and for the good of, you know, our future, because I truly agree with Jim. I think the technology advances that have resulted from energy development, whether it be from the renewable sector or from the oil and gas industry, have been remarkable. In the last decade. I mean, in the last 10 years, we built 90 new manufacturing facilities in the U.S. to build just wind turbines and piece parts of wind turbines and blades and towers. And that has added to the renaissance. But the natural gas sector has contributed to that renaissance by providing the power. So we're all part of a solution. But there has to be more dialogue that's depoliticized, that's working together towards trying to solve these problems and always put the individual and the public and the consumer at the top of our goals of who we're out to take care of and protect, both from an economic standpoint as well as a health standpoint.
Yeah, and from the oil and gas sector, we see the energy future as being one of growing renewables, and really the energy needs of the nation are so vast that we really do need everything, and I think I mentioned this earlier. There's no desire to push other sectors out of the American landscape. We recognize that we're going to need everything. There's an awful lot of power that is needed to run our economy, and it can't just be produced from one sector or the other. We need all.
That's right.
Thank you.
Good question.
Hi, I'm Bobby McGill, science writer for Climate Central in New York. This is to Jim Roth. Oklahoma was one of the first states to allow utilities to charge homeowners a fee for placing solar panels on their roofs, and the state passed the solar surcharge bill in 2014. And I'm wondering what you think the effect of that has been over the last year and a half, over the on the willingness of Oklahomans to entertain the idea of rooftop solar and of developing further distributed generation.
Yeah, is this a setup, Bobby? We've never met before, but I represent the Alliance for Solar Choice, which is the sixth largest rooftop solar manufacturer, so I'm not sure if it's appropriate for me to answer.
Well, I'm curious about your perspective on that.
Yeah, I'm litigating that case against our state's largest utility right now.
I was unaware of that. I apologize.
Okay, it's all right. I will back up a little bit to share something about the question. The legislature did pass the law. There's no determination of a dollar amount yet on a distributed generation customer. That's the purpose of this case. So I won't speak specifically to why I think this utility is wrong and what they're asking for. But I'll share with you that if your business is to strangle out other forms of competition, you will wither on the vine. And so in my opinion, utilities across this country ought to be talking to their customers about mutually beneficial energy solutions. And if that means an aggregated community solution for rooftop solar, great. If that means incremental cost to connect, because we know rooftop solar is on average across this country, don't generate 100% of what they need. They still rely on the socialized system that we have. And I think it needs to be part of the debate. But Oklahoma is finding its way through that. I think the law is unfortunate. I think utilities standing in the way of customer choice is a sign of their early demise.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Riley Dunlap. Actually, I'm a faculty member at Oklahoma State, but there's no one else up here with a blue dot, so I figure we can come up, and I'm a speaker.
You're good.
I have a question. The issue of infrastructure has come up several times, and we all hear stories. We know the grim tales about bridges falling down, railroads are in horrible shape, our electrical grid system. I mean, we're kind of becoming like a second or third world nation. So my question is to Kyle. One of the things I saw here, which didn't surprise me, was that the fossil fuels industry is now, you know, giving more political contributions than ever. And approximately 95%, I think, was going to one particular political party. But so that particular political party...
What is the question?
Well, right here, it's coming. That party seems incapable of even taking care of our bridges, our roads, or anything. So isn't it more progressive for fossil fuels to want a Congress that, you know, helps you do your job, that creates good rail systems and all that? So I'm just truly at my question is, shouldn't the fossil fuels industry be a little more progressive, spread your money around, and get some people in Congress who will, in fact, improve our infrastructure?
Well, I'm glad you asked the question, because actually it allows me to clarify something. The fossil fuel industry does not side with one political party or another, at least certainly API, that my organization does not. And we do have a political action committee within API, and the API PAC does not distribute funding based on political party. They distribute funding based on who's for a reasonable energy policy that allows oil and gas to continue to provide energy to America. So it just so happens.
Yeah, it just so happens
that a lot of those people tend to be from one party,
yeah,
and not the other. And frankly, you know, in a perfect world, the parties wouldn't be quite so polarized, and we would see more more representatives from both sides of the aisle towards the middle, and we would have a much more even-handed discussion.
See, you're just...
Next question.
If I can speak to that thought just for a moment.
Let him
speak to your question.
I'm sorry. I apologize.
I thought to that. One aspect of the oil and gas industry that I think is overlooked is something that I remember having been a local county commissioner here in Oklahoma. And that is at the severance or gross production point of taxation in Oklahoma, about 10% of that goes to local counties and cities for roads and bridge purposes. There's a direct correlation. They remit the tax to the state tax commission. It doesn't get lost in the state legislator or governor process. It is remitted directly back on a road and bridge formula, as you know, in Payne County, just like here in Oklahoma County. And it's the source of revenue for local government to do a great portion of its road and infrastructure and bridge work. And so it's something that I think is often overlooked. I hear what you're saying. You're talking about political support for that issue. But every day, there's a small well out somewhere in Oklahoma that's remitting tax to the road that runs nearby it, and a lot of people just don't understand that.
And sir, I want to give the rest of the audience members who want to ask a question time to do so. So can you follow up with our panelists afterwards? I would appreciate that. I'm going to take your mic away.
My question's simple.
I'm going to take your mic away. Thank you.
Hi, Mike Sorahan with Energy Wire. And, thank you, Mr. Issachar, for bringing that a little bit back to what our general understanding is on the partisan divide there. But that's not my question. I believe, Aaron, you said at the beginning that you'd like to hear some questions on earthquakes. I'm the official obsessed person on designated obsessive on earthquakes, and I haven't really formulated a general question, so I can just say, in you know, what is everyone's take generally on how the state is dealing with earthquakes?
Well, and my question had been, obviously we're seeing a huge increase in earthquakes. Hard to parse. How do we address the issue, and what kind of accountability does the industry have?
So, and let me just throw in, you get two former corporation commissioners here, so they're right in the middle of it. So.
Well, yes. And I've monitored the issue on behalf of a few hedge funds that have significant exposure to E&P companies in Oklahoma. So I've tried to stay close to the issue. Denise and I had a chance to visit about this over lunch. We both are very complimentary to the way this current commission is handling it. And what I mean by that is they've waited for the science to lead the reaction. They first made sure the science was coming together. The governor appointed a coordinating council that I think had people who could bring that information together that was previously just kind of broken out across the process. So that, along with the Oklahoma Geological Survey, some expertise from outside the state, have all come in here to try to help us figure out what's the cause and what can be done to perhaps keep an economy and an energy source going for the sake of our people, but not increasing the risk. It's a real problem, and we're finding our way through it. But with the help of science and with the help of, I think, moderate incremental touches from the regulatory body, we first ended up with very high volume, high pressure disposal wells in the northern part of the state in southern Kansas, in the Mississippi line. It's very water rich. That was one solution. Let's have all of them confirm that they're not into the crystalline basement. Let's plug back. Those operators incurred that cost voluntarily without the commission having to do any enforcement action. Next, we realized that there was aggregated fault line impacts happening. There was a directive that we encouraged them to confirm where they were, and the operators, nobody resisted it at all. What I mean by that is they didn't go in on a permit-by-permit basis and basically force. The commission has enforcement authority under its rules, and they didn't take that step. Then there was this aggregated fault line realization through the science that even in non-high-volume or high-pressure disposal well locations, there was so much water having aggregated itself around particular fault lines in the Arbuckle Formation and elsewhere that they then had to do a second directive. As you mentioned, all this again within 2015. Now there's been a third one. This issue is going to play out, but I'm really thankful so far that we are gathering the data, going through it, and trying to make some immediate reaction, but not an overreach and not too little. And I think this commission has done a good job so far.
I agree, and I think, my experience with the commission and the oil and gas division in particular of the Oklahoma Commission is it's run really by the experts. The commissioners had always, under my 10 years there, and I think the same was true of Jim's, deferred to the expertise of our staff, we held them accountable for addressing problems. We were the sheriff. We're not beholden to the oil and gas industry. We're beholden to the people. But we are to be fair, and we're to do things in a way that can be accomplished, and that we have to have good data before we make a call. And that was the one thing the commission led the country in Oklahoma, was going back out very early in the process and saying, we don't have information. And they did put out instructions to the industry to start gathering data, that now these directives to the industry, looking at different hydrology and geology in our state, which is very different, if you know the geology of our state, but really directing them on a geology and hydrology basis as to what to do. And the fact that they've acted three times, I think, really, compared to what other parts of the country are doing, I think, again, setting a good example by letting the experts, letting the sheriff, who Tim Baker is our sheriff at the Oklahoma Corporation Commission, let him do his job and let them, the staff, do their job and back them up. And don't let it become a political decision.
Kyle.
And I would simply echo what Jim and Denise have said. I think they're exactly right. I think they've got it right in that we're addressing this issue at the state level, and that's also confirmed by the recent IOGCC, Groundwater Protection Council, joint report that also agreed that the oversight of induced seismicity should be at the state level. And of course, to Aaron's point, what's on the oil and gas industry? Yeah, we do have a responsibility. We need to work with the states, and particularly the state of Oklahoma, to ensure that when we're siting these flowback water disposal wells, that we're doing it in a way that reduces the risk of any seismic activity to the extent possible. And that's on us.
Oh,
hi. And this will be the last question.
Okay.
Thank you.
My name is James Sims. I'm a Forbes contributor and a freelance journalist in Tokyo. And you talk about these 4.0 earthquakes, and it doesn't even, I can't even register them. But just as a question.
You're clearly not from California.
Tokyo.
Well, we had a 9.0 several years
ago. Yeah, you had a very significant one.
But my question is on exports of energy, especially natural gas. Japan and South Korea are probably, I think, they're the largest natural gas importers in the world, number
China
one.
China just surpassed Japan last year.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay, so anyway, we've got, in Northeast Asia, we have the top three, and there's been a great deal of discussion about exports, to Asia from the Gulf and maybe the Pacific and maybe even the East Coast. And I'm just wondering about the potential, I guess, energy security risks as well as environmental risks. Because if something happens, you don't know whether there will be a really tight crackdown, like on regulations, for example, on fracking, or if energy prices rise, there might be a push to try to restrict the exports. And so from the standpoint of the importers, I'm wondering what sort of security risks should they be thinking about going forward over the next 10, 15 years when the exports start?
Sure. Well, let me jump in. Clearly, LNG exports are a huge potential driver for the U.S. We have an enormous supply of natural gas here in the United States. It's been estimated at least over 100 years of current demand we have in terms of supply that can be accessed using today's technology. So even without any technology advancements, we've already got the ability to power the United States for another 100 years in terms of our natural gas demand. So it is likely that natural gas will be coming, will be exported in the very near future. In terms of the liabilities, I think you hit on it. There is a potential through overzealous regulation, if you will, to reduce our ability to produce natural gas and oil through the through fracking technology to the point where they no longer become economically viable, and that frankly is my biggest fear when I look at the ability for the United States to not only provide natural gas for its own use but also to export it and provide a lower carbon alternative to other energy sources overseas. And let's not forget also to also provide some geopolitical benefits there, where our allies can have a friendly source of natural gas, as opposed to, let's say, less than friendly source suppliers of natural gas. There's a lot of benefits in this, and the real concern that I have, frankly, is regulatorily. It's not technology, it's not resource-based. It's really from a regulatory standpoint. If it just becomes too difficult to produce natural gas, then we're going to find ourselves missing that great economic and geopolitical opportunity.
James, I'll share with you, the last couple of years I had occasion to do two foreign trips on natural gas issues. I had a chance to speak at the American Chamber of Commerce in Beijing, and I noticed as they were, you know, building that first final cross-country pipeline and trying to do a lot with BP and Royal Dutch Shell and the big players, the Sichuan province sulfur content is probably so much, and they have such an enormous appetite that you're going to continue to see, I think, the need to import to markets like that. Certainly Peabody and coal producers are hoping they still have an appetite for coal. But when you look at the price difference for what's called the Japanese cocktail, any American industrial producer is going to want to be a part of that space when you're dealing with the prices you're dealing with here in America. So I understand that we're coming into a point to kind of conflict where the market is attractive beyond our own borders. Now, if you're an American industrial processor manufacturer, you obviously don't want to see the demand tighten here. Secondly, I'll share with you that I traveled to Tanzania with another foundation trying to help these new sub-Saharan democracies who have enormous natural gas finds, 43 trillion cubic feet off the shore of Tanzania, with the Chinese trying to build an LNG port to basically take the resource. So you end up trying to figure out, from America's perspective and a geopolitical standpoint, wouldn't you like to see a self-sufficient Africa where the countries are learning to live on their own and benefit their own people, rather than the need for aid to help prop up and hopefully avoid famines like we've seen recently? And I'll just transition to a question I'd like to leave with all of you, something that I haven't figured out in my own head, and that is, do you think or do you not think that America's oil and gas success over the last few years has maybe given this president, for the first time in maybe 50 years, a longer deliberation time about whether to go to war in the Middle East? I wonder, are we not in Syria today like we were in Iraq and Kuwait in dealing with helping Israel in the Yom Kippur War and everything we've done over the last 40 years because we're maybe realizing we can lean on ourselves a little bit? I don't have the answer, and I know there's a lot of human suffering in Syria, and I'm not trying to discount that, but I wonder, there is a balance in there somewhere, and American producers and our own need for energy security is maybe giving us a chance to start to figure out what our role is in the world going forward. And just a thought I wanted to leave with you all.
All right, and on that note, we are only 2 minutes over time, yay! So, I want to thank all of our panelists for agreeing to come and give us their insights.